Novelist and screenwriter Don Snyder has just published a new memoir about his time spent caddying for his golfer son. But the story he's burning to tell is about his mother. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Don Snyder never knew his mother. She died just 16 days after he and his twin brother were born in 1950. The truth about her death remained a secret for decades. Today, he'll tell us her story. And we are in the final 24 hours of our fall membership drive. Please take a moment to invest in Iowa Public Radio at iowapublicradio.org. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Novelist and screenwriter Don Snyder has just published a new memoir. It's called Walking with Jack, and it tells the story of his experience caddying for his golfer son. But it's another story that he is burning to tell, the story of his mother, who died when she was just 19 years old. Good morning, Don.
Good morning, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
It's great to be here.
Now, when you were growing up, your mother passed away in 1950. And when you were growing up with your twin brother, you didn't know very much about her. She died just 16 days after you were born. When did you start asking questions?
Well, I knew nothing about her. Actually, we lived three blocks from the cemetery where she was buried, and no one ever took us there. My father remarried when I was five. And that was the only mother I ever knew. Once I saw him looking at a photograph of a young bride who didn't really look like the mother I knew, but I never asked any questions. I was very little at the time. I was five or six. And my father and I became sort of estranged in this world, separated. And a book that I had written took me to Oprah, of all things, to Oprah's stage. And it was not long after that, maybe 2 days, when I got a call from my father. He had actually seen me on Oprah. We hadn't seen each other in many years. And he told me he had been diagnosed with a brain tumor. He was living in Pennsylvania. I was in Maine, and he asked me to come down. And I was sitting there with him in his little apartment, and he pulled out a wedding album and said, this is a picture of your mother, who you never knew, who died after you were born. So that's really when it began. That would have been the winter of 1998 is when that happened. I was 48 years old.
So it had been almost five decades.
Yeah, almost half a century.
When you started learning about your mother, what pieces of her life were you able to put together 50 years later?
Well, it was a slow process of research. I think this was my fifth or sixth book at the time, so I was pretty familiar with how to do research and how to write books. But I went down to the little town in Hatfield, Pennsylvania, and started knocking on doors. First, I went to the newspaper office and was going through old clippings. And after I think it was a day and a half of doing that, I found a headline in the little newspaper that said, "Young mother of twins dies." And it was the face. There was the picture of the woman that I'd seen in the photograph album. So I knew that she had died, and I read a little bit about her. She was 19 years old. She died and 16 days after we were born. But really, Charity, in that little town in Pennsylvania, 50 years later, everybody remembered that.
Really?
I mean, a young mother dies and leaves behind twin boys, and my father took us to the Lutheran orphanage, and then he couldn't leave us there, and he drove us back home. So I found all the bridesmaids from the wedding, who were now elderly women in their 70s. I found the girl who played field hockey with her. I found, her teachers, some of her school teachers. And most of all, I found a nurse who was retired. I think she was 74, and she had been sitting beside my mother on the morning she died, and she'd written down my mother's last words on a little scrap of paper. In those days, nurses wrote down everything on paper. There were no, computers, of course. And she placed that scrap of paper in my hand, which was pretty remarkable to me. And then I went to the grave, and saw the headstone. And my father's name was engraved next to hers, waiting for him to die and, you know, be buried there beside her. So that's when that was the beginning part of my research. And the amazing thing was that my father, and I never knew whether this was attributable to his brain tumor or just a kind of amnesia that he had to survive. He didn't remember anything. He couldn't remember where they went on their honeymoon. He couldn't remember where they went on when they were dating. They were only together for 9 months, just over 9 months. But I began to think that my task as a writer was to write their love story and sort of and give it back to him, give him back the love story that he had forgotten, either out of necessity or out of his illness. So I set out and I just wrote a beautiful love story. And there was only one mystery at that time. I found, first of all, the hospital told me that all the records from, you know, that time had been destroyed when they built the new hospital. But then someone in the records department found a single index card. It was an orange index card that had been taped to the railing of her bed. And on the card, it said there were four lines. It said, Peggy Snyder, twins at full term, eclampsia, which was a word I'd never heard before, and then the doctor's name, Dr. Clinton Towey. Well, I tried to get the death certificate, and the hospital said, well, you're going to need to get the doctor's permission for that. And I said, well, surely he can't still be alive. And they said, oh, he's alive, and he lives about a half a mile from here. So I went to his door with that index card in my pocket, and he said to me, these are his exact words, your mother was never my patient. I delivered 1,000 babies in my career, and I never lost a single mother.
Wow.
And in that moment, I could have confronted him, but I have to say this. I felt that if I went through that door, I was going to find something that I didn't want to find. And so I finessed it as a writer. And in the book, I just said he was probably standing on some patient-doctor confidentiality even after all these years.
And so you wrote this memoir mm-hmm. about your mother's life
mm-hmm.
without the information from her doctor.
Right.
And you published that memoir. It's called Of Time and Memory.
Right. It was published by Alfred A. Knopf. Yeah, I can tell you this, Charity. I justified it. At the time, I was reading a biography of FDR. And in the biography, the writer did not mention anything about the affair FDR had had all through the end of, you know, near the end of his life with, I forget her name, Mercer, I think. And I saw an interview with him, and somebody said to him, why didn't you write about the affair? And he said, I wrote my book. You write that book if you want to. So, you know, a writer has a certain authority over the material. And basically, I was afraid that on the other side of that door, I mean, why would the doctor lie to me after all those years? I felt that there might be something there that would make the book really, really sad and dark. And my father was already, he had been really deranged by sadness his whole life. I can tell you my first memory of him, I lived with my grandmother and he lived there. I thought he was my brother, really. And my grandmother was icing a cake on the kitchen table, she said to me, Donnie, it's your daddy's birthday. Go find him. And I knew right where he would be. I went out the back door of the kitchen, down the little walkway. He used to sit in his car in the alley. And when he saw me coming, he rolled up all the windows.
Oh.
That was my dad. He was lost in his own world of grief and desolation, really. So I pulled back. I pulled up that punch that you do sometimes as a writer and thought, well, I'll just rest on this beautiful love story, and that will be the end of it.
But that wasn't the end of it.
No, it was not.
So you went on the Today Show,
mm-hmm.
and you were talking about this book.
I was. I was talking about the book, talking about how my grandfather had sold all their possessions on the sidewalk the day after she was buried, including her little Singer sewing machine. She had sewed all her baby clothes, and people told me that her light was the only light on in town, that little light on the top of the sewing machine late at night. And when I got back to my hotel room, two things happened. One woman from Milwaukee called the Today Show and said, I have the sewing machine. Her mother had been living in that little town, and she had the sewing machine. So she sent it to me. I now have it. The second thing that happened was that my wife called me from Maine and said, a doctor called here looking for you. And it was, in fact, Dr. Clinton Toey. So I returned the call.
And this was the man who had turned you away.
Right.
At his door.
Who had said, your mother was never my patient. And all he said to me was, I read your book. You got it wrong.
So
that was it.
How did you respond when he said that to you?
Well, I asked him to tell me what happened, and he said, no. He said, I've said enough. You got it wrong. You know, I mean, I was on this book tour across the country. It was somewhat of a celebrated book. It was on the front page of USA Today, and they never put books on the front page. And I was traveling all around. It was like it was supposed to be a moment of triumph. I mean, really, Tiffany, I was able to say to myself, Charity, as a writer, this was probably the one book that I was put on this earth to write, and now I find out that I got it wrong. So it was really,
really
tough.
Sucked the wind out of your sails.
Yeah, it was very, very tough.
All right. So as a writer, and if people listening have read your books, they know that you also have been a bit of an investigative journalist at times with
right.
some of your books. As a writer, I can't imagine you being able to let something like that go.
No, but it was a question of how to proceed. I mean, for a while, I tried to get to lose myself in other stories. You remember the terrible bombing in Oma in Northern Ireland, the IRA bombing in the summer of 98? I flew over there 17 hours after the bombing. I was walking through the wreckage there, and then I spent 9 months there, and then I wrote a novel there. I went to 13 funerals. I was sitting at the funeral of Avril Monaghan. She had been killed in the blast with her three-year-old daughter holding her hand and her twins in her belly. And when I was at her grave, that was really it. That was the moment when I said to myself, I've got to find out what happened to my mom. You know, I've got to find out the whole story.
The image of a young woman pregnant with twins
yeah.
brought your mom back to
yeah.
you.
I was sitting right there, you know, at the grave. It was the only square grave I've ever seen in my life. They buried all three of the girls right with her, right with the mother. Yeah, so I went home to Maine, and I said to Colleen, well, I don't know what's on the other side of that door, but I'm going to knock it down if I have to, you know.
But that information was locked inside the brain of the doctor.
The doctor.
So you only had one possible way to find that information.
Right. Well, the first little – well, I had the other word on that card, which was eclampsia. And so I learned about eclampsia, and it's actually referred to as preeclampsia, and it is still the leading cause of death among pregnant women and their babies all over the world, even today. They've never known the cause and the cure. Basically, it's when the fetus begins to poison the mother. So, I mean, I certainly knew that my brother and I had killed our mother, if you want to put it that way. But why this doctor had refused to talk to me, I couldn't really understand. And, I kept calling him and writing him, and he kept refusing to talk to me until finally, I mean, I just persisted. I think I wrote two more novels. I wrote a movie in that time. And then finally I got through to him. And then he told me the whole story.
All right. And we're going to find out that whole story in a few minutes. But when you finally got him to talk, what was your reaction? How did you feel when he said okay? Or how did he say okay?
He said it over the phone, and I said, boy, I wish you hadn't lied to me, you know, when I was standing on your doorstep. And he said, well, your mother and I had a certain understanding. And there was a promise between us, and it was one that I did not want to violate. I mean, you have to remember, this is the other thing he told me. He said, you didn't write about this in your book, but after she died, everybody in this town blamed me for her death. And there was talk among people that I should be sued for malpractice. He was the only obstetrician in that area. Everybody else was just a family doctor. Very intelligent man. When I was speaking with him, in 1998, I think he was 78 years old. He was well into his 80s by the time he finally told me the whole story. But it was a promise that he had made, you know, to my mother that he was standing on.
He must have been a young doctor.
He was right out of medical school, yeah. It was his first. I mean, we were his first set of twins that he ever delivered. He remembered that very clearly.
Where were you when he told you the story?
I was in Maine. I was sitting on the chair by the telephone, And I said, "Do you want me to come down there?" And he said, "No, I don't need you to come down." And what he told me only took 5 minutes, but it was, you know, it opened up the whole story.
Well, we're going to find out what he told you in just a few minutes. I'm talking with Don Snyder. He's a novelist, a memoirist, a screenwriter. He's also a graduate of the Iowa Writers Workshop, and he will be reading from his new memoir. It's called Walking with Jack. It tells the story of his experience caddying for his son as his son tried to make it as a professional golfer. He'll be reading from that story tonight at Prairie Lights Bookstore. Oh, Saturday night, pardon me, Saturday night at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City at 7 o'clock. Saturday night, pardon me. And we'll continue our conversation in just a moment. Again, I'm talking with Don Snyder. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and my guest this hour is author and screenwriter Don Snyder. He's just published a new memoir. It's called Walking with Jack, which tells the story of his experience caddying for his son as his son tried to make it as a professional golfer. He'll be reading from his memoir Saturday evening at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City at 7 o'clock. He's also a University of Iowa Writers Workshop graduate many years ago. But there is another story that we've been talking about this hour, and this is the story that drives him. This is the story that he is burning to tell. He wrote a memoir about his mother and her untimely death when she was 19 years old, just 16 days after he and his twin brother were born, published that memoir of time and memory, and then learned shortly thereafter that he didn't know the whole story. And that's the point where we were when we took a break, Don. So finally, after the memoir was published and you were doing publicity for it, her doctor, who had refused to talk to you before, got in touch with you and said, "You got it all wrong." Mm-hmm. You finally convinced him to tell you the story. You're on the phone with him, and he was able to tell you in about 5 minutes what this big secret was. What did he tell you?
Well, the first thing he told me was a rather stunning image. He told me, he said, "Did anyone tell you that in the months after your mother died that your father slept every night on her grave at the Lutheran cemetery beneath his army blanket?" He said, "I used to see him there in the morning when I would go through town." And that let me know immediately that there was a deep level of sorrow in this whole thing. What he said to me was, "Your mother's doctor was a Dr. Paul Moyers. He was a family doctor. He'd been her doctor since she was a little girl. And he came to me in the fourth month of her pregnancy and said, 'I have a patient I'd like you to see who's suffering from really extreme toxemia for this early in her pregnancy, and I might need your help.' And by that, he meant, I am a family doctor, and if it comes to the point of being able to save only one, the baby or the mother, I will have to save the baby. And in this case, I will not even tell the mother that she's dying. I won't tell her husband. I'll tell her father. I'll tell her minister, and that's the way it is. But you might be able to treat this differently." And it was really a matter of the young obstetrician saying that he understood and he would see her.
And so this was a veiled way of saying, you could perform an abortion and save this woman's life.
Yeah, it wouldn't have been – the word abortion was never used, and he didn't use the word either. It was just a question of inducing labor. I have to back up a minute, though. That young obstetrician, the first delivery he did in that town was to a woman who couldn't keep her baby. And he took the infant to the Lutheran orphanage. It was at night. And it was during a thunderstorm. And the girl on duty at the orphanage that night was my mother at age 17. And he placed the baby in her arms. And my mother had a habit of naming all the babies after movie stars. And she named this one Perry Como. And this doctor never forgot that. So 2 years later, he's asked to see a patient. He agrees. And in comes the girl he'd seen at the Lutheran orphanage. And I think it rocked him in a way. I think he might have even been a little bit in love with her in a way, by how he spoke on the phone to me. Anyway, he laid it out. He said, I told your mother in the fourth month that if her condition got worse, I would have to induce labor. Everybody in town would just think she'd had a miscarriage and she would live on in the world. And she was very upset with me and she refused to talk to me about it. She left. In the sixth month, she was so sick and so swollen. I mean, her feet were so swollen that she couldn't even fit into my dad's slippers. She came to his office barefoot to have him induce labor and save her life. She was just so, so sick. And he was doing a routine exam with a stethoscope before the procedure, and he heard two hearts beating instead of one. And he told her she was carrying twins, and she just said, well, I can't do it then. So he said to me, I sent her home to die. And I stood across the street when they buried her. And she made me promise two things before the end of her life. He went to visit her in the hospital. Well, he delivered her babies at 3 o'clock in the morning, his first set of twins. And the next day when he talked to her, she said to him, if I do die, you have to promise me you'll never tell anyone because I don't want these babies to grow up knowing that they'd caused my death. And even more important, according to Dr. Towey, I don't want my husband to know, because how will he ever be able to be a good father to these boys if he knows that they caused my death? So that was the promise that he had kept all those years, even through the months afterwards when he was accused of, you know, malpractice. It was really amazing.
When he told you that story, and you thought about your 19-year-old mother knowing that she had to choose between her babies and herself, and she had to choose between her babies and her husband.
Yeah.
What did you think about?
I can remember being, number one, I can remember being grateful that I didn't write it in the book, even though the book was incomplete, and I knew I had to atone for that in some way. I was glad I didn't write it in the book because my dad never would have been able to endure that. The other thing, well, there was an immediate shock and then the deep sorrow, but then I can remember saying to Colleen, I have to make up for this somehow. I'm not going to be able to tell the whole story till after my father dies. And I thought he would die rather quickly. My brother did too, but he lived on till 2010. I actually carried this story inside me for a long time. And as I say, I mean, I had four children to raise, so I wrote three or four more novels during that time.
Now, we all know that you have a twin brother.
Right.
Obviously, that was a big part of your mother's story and her decision. Did you tell him this story?
Of course I did. And my brother by then was a Lutheran minister. And this was a Lutheran town. And the doctor was a Lutheran doctor. And he said to me, I said, Dave, will you do me a favor? Will you look up, can you go back and find out if, in fact, that was the position of the Lutheran Church at that time? And he said, I don't have to look it up. I can tell you that it was. If only the mother or the baby could be saved, you always save the baby. So it was really a lot to carry around. And I mean, I can remember going through, Colleen would tell you, about 2 years when none of my clothes seemed to fit me anymore. You know, that's how bad it was. I felt like I had betrayed my mother in some way. I'd written this book that everybody was saying was so beautiful, and yet it was incomplete and wrong. And no one prepared me for that at the Iowa Writers' Workshop. I can tell you that there would be one story out there that would go on to define my life, and then I would get it wrong. But, you know, I'm here in Iowa City now, and I, for the first time in 30 years, and I'm looking at the young people here, and I'll be teaching a screenwriting class this afternoon. And, I mean, I would tell them that there's one thing they really have to have if they're going to have a chance to write and to write something important. They've got to find one person in this world who believes that they're real, even when they don't believe they're real. And most of your life as a writer, you don't believe you're real. And in those months and then years after learning this, I think Colleen was the only person who still thought I was real.
Your wife.
Yeah.
In your new memoir, you write about your relationship with your son, but also about your other children as well. You have four kids, right. three daughters and mm-hmm. one son. And you, in part of the book, you describe to your son what it's like to become a father, to have a child. And you write about it so beautifully. But what did you tell him?
Well, I can remember, gosh, that journey in walking with Jack, I mean, I went over to Scotland and lived for 2 years to train as a caddy at the Old Course in St. Andrews to learn all I could from those great Scottish caddies so that I could be of use to my son, who was getting better at golf and he was going to make a run for the Pro Tour. I think that the one thing that I told him was that, you know, looking back over my long run as a father with three daughters and a son, most of your life as a father you spend fixing things. You know, first of all, it's the little things like the dolls' heads that fall off or the wheels that fall off. And then it's bigger things like bicycles and then finally cars. And I can remember saying to Jack, if you're ever a father, you'll reach the point where you realize that the stuff that's broken is the stuff inside them that you can't fix. And that's really tough, the stuff that they have to sort of fix on their own. And, you know, we had a lot of moments. We lived together in one motel room for 4 months without killing each other, you know, in Houston, Texas, a strange place for someone from Maine. And we used to start out talking about golf and end up talking about life, you know, just about every night. And I was able to finally tell him the whole story of my mom and this journey that I'd been on, you know. In those days, Charity, I was like, I figured the only way that I could make up for this failure in the book or this inability to tell the whole story was to write a movie. I didn't know any other way. And it's interesting that when I was in the writer's workshop here, I wandered over to the film department and signed up and took a screenwriting course. It was the only screenwriting course I ever took. And I think I was the only writer from the workshop who took it. It was taught by a guy named Steve Kopelke. I can still remember the first day I went in there. And so I told Jack, you know, there were 2 years in your life when you didn't see me. And that's because I was upstairs locked in a room studying all the great screenplays, trying to learn how to write a script well enough to tell, you know, my mother's, your grandmother's story. And during that time, I mean, I was trying to apologize for him. As a writer, the world inside your head is often more real than the world in front of you. I can remember distinctly coming downstairs during that time, and there would be Colleen and the four kids, and I was looking at them like, you know, who are these people and where'd they come from? You know, they're not in the story that I'm living inside my mind. So during that time, I taught myself how to write scripts, and then a novel of mine called Fallen Angel was bought by Hallmark Hall of Fame. And I can remember my agent in Hollywood saying, if you insist on writing this screenplay, there's probably a 1 in 70,000 chance that it'll get made. But I said, you don't understand. I have to write it because I have to write my mother's screenplay someday. And sure enough, it was made. I can remember being on the set of the movie in Ontario with Gary Sinise, who starred in it. And when we shook hands for the first time, I said to him, you know, our paths have crossed for a reason that has nothing to do with this movie. It's because of a 19-year-old girl who died a half a century ago. And he looked at me like I was just another crazy writer. But anyway, with my son on the tour, I think we just got the chance to talk about all the things that matter, you know, in this world. I mean, I wanted to do that. When he was 5 years old, I remember putting a sawed-off golf club in his hand for the first time, and he hit the first ball I dropped in front of him like he'd been playing golf in another life. You know, you have these moments with your little babies. We had four babies in 5 years, and you think you're going to have them forever. And, you know, Lord knows some days are interminable, you know. But then there's always a moment where you catch a glance of them, and you realize that they're going to go on and be their own people, and they're going to leave you. And I said to Jack, in that moment, you know, you ever get good enough at golf to make it to a pro tour and I want to be your caddy. It was really just, you know, a father wanting to walk beside his son for as long as possible. And believe me, Charity, during the teenage years when he despised me, I used to use that against him. I said, when you get mad at me, I said, don't you forget, someday I'm going to caddy for you on a pro tour.
Well, you write a lot in your memoir about your desire to be close to your kids and to extend the closeness that you had when they were little.
Right.
And you seem to have a real fear of losing that. Is that because of your dad?
I think so. I was, you know, my dad lost me. I mean, I was never able to crack him open and find out, you know, really what he was afraid of. You know, he was a guy who stood out on the back lawn at night smoking his pipe and looking up at the stars, and I never found out what he was thinking about or what he was wondering about. You know, these people, I mean, the love story that carries us into this world, we almost never know in any of its real important detail. And those people who were young, they exist in the old photographs that we look at from time to time, but we never really know the love story that carried us into the world, which is sort of sad in a way, because those people in those photographs remain strangers to us, really, most of our lives.
And so, even more so in your case.
Yeah, so and in that sense, it's no wonder that often we feel like strangers even to ourselves. So I used the time with Jack to tell him the love story that I had with his mother, number one, and to tell him the love story that had carried me into the world, you know, that set me on the path.
And he didn't really know your dad well.
Oh, no. No. He'd seen him. You could count on one hand the number of times. My dad was lingering on with his brain tumor. It took his vision. It took his, you know, his mental capacities. But no, I never really had much time to spend with Jack and my father, no.
There is a very interesting moment between you and Jack when he urges you to have a conversation about forgiveness with your dad, but it's not the conversation that you've always thought about having, where your dad says, "Hey, I'm sorry, I wasn't there for you." What did Jack think needed to happen?
Yeah, that's right, Charity. That was really the turning point. I told him the whole story as I knew it, everything that Dr. Toey had told me. I tried to explain to Jack why I'd been locked in my room so many years trying to get this story right. He actually called me once and he said, "Have you been down to see Granddad?" And I said, "Yeah, I went down there." And he said, it was an interesting thing for a kid to say. He said, "So was there, you know," I think it was out of a Bruce Springsteen line. "Is there any forgiveness between the two of you?" And I said, "You know, Jack, I don't really hold it against my dad that he was never able to talk to me or be close to me or anything. I forgave him for that a long time ago." And Jack said, "That's not what I'm talking about, man. I'm talking about him forgiving you." And I said, "For what?" He said, "Well, you killed his wife, his bride." You know, it was like in from the mouths of babes. You know, it was like I never had even thought about it from that side of the equation.
Right. And that was what your mother was trying to protect you from your father blaming you.
Exactly.
But he couldn't help but feel that obviously your arrival and her departure were connected.
Yeah, exactly. So that really turned the whole screenplay for me. I mean, I began to see it from another. Sometimes in order to get at the truth, we do have to sort of step out of ourselves and see ourselves and our stories, you know, from another perspective, from some distance.
Well, Jack gave you a lot of insight into your story as you tried to help him with what you felt was his big dream. And it was his big dream to be a professional golfer. But you also get some insight into how he's different from you.
Right. Right.
He's not the big dreamer you are.
Exactly. He's a very practical person as a result of growing up with a father who's a dreamer, you know. And that's part of the lesson in this book. And I think Walking with Jack has, you know, I think it has resonance and some truth in it for everyone. I mean, you have to let your children are going to be who they are. I thought we were just getting started on that pro tour in Houston. I thought in 3 years we'd be going to Q school and we'd give it a shot at the big show. But Jack had his own equation in mind. If he didn't win there, he was not going to, you know, he was not going to try to persuade himself that he had what it took. He was going to get a real job.
So that, for him, that was the end of the road. Hey, I'm almost good enough to be he was a pro golfer, but
right.
He was almost good enough to be in the money.
Mm-hmm.
And you thought that was going to be the beginning of his journey.
Yeah. And we were driving home from Texas and I realized something sitting next to him. He did all the driving. which used to drive me crazy, but he did all the driving. And I realized that he saw the grace that attends an ordinary life. And that was something I'd never seen. That's something that big dreamers almost never see. And he was content. He's now working for Sherwin-Williams, managing a paint store, and he's happy, and he's going to get married in November to the girl he loves, and he's going to live an ordinary life with some grace in it.
He also said to you, Dad, you have to tell, except he called you Daddy.
Yeah, he still calls me Daddy.
Right, Daddy, you have to tell your mom's story. You have to get this screenplay made. Why did he say that to you?
I think he knew that I would reach the end of my life and feel like somehow I had failed it or it was incomplete. But, you know, again, it had to wait until my father died. I sat with my dad on the last night of his life, and that's really where I began sketching out the last scenes to the screenplay.
So why is this so important? Jack saw it. You're here today. You should be selling a book right now,
I know.
But instead you're talking about your mother's story. Why is this so important to you?
Well, it's important to me on a personal level. And then, I mean, I feel like it's my duty to carry her story out into the world as far as I can. And I think it's a story that will live across time. You know, one of those stories. And I have to also say that because my mother, you know, at age 19, experienced all the emotions on both sides of what's become in this country a divide over abortion, over women's rights, I feel that it's the kind of film, if it's done properly, that might draw opposing sides together. You know, I've done a lot of thinking about this charity. You know, you see a beautiful movie, a beautiful love story, the sacrifice of a young girl, the confusion that she had to live with before she made her decision. And I think no matter where you stand on these issues, if you begin to catch a glimpse of yourself in her life, in her doubt, in her confusion, and then finally in her decision, that you might, that opposing sides might be drawn together. I think we need a story like this right now.
Is there hope for getting this film made?
Oh, yeah, there's hope. I've talked with a number of producers about it. I was once under contract with a producer for HBO, but at the time, it wasn't right. My dad was still alive. I think this movie will be made in the next couple of years.
What are the other stories hanging out there for you? Or is this the one?
This is the one. I mean, this is the one I have to carry across the finish line. You know, I should also say that, I mean, right here in Iowa City this weekend is the Preeclampsia Foundation's annual gathering. I mean, I'm committed to working with this foundation, and also the University of Chicago Hospital, where some of the research has been done for the last 60 years, to get the movie made and to have a portion of the profits go to finding a cure.
Don, thank you so much.
Thank you, Charity.
Don Snyder, his most recent book is a memoir. It's called Walking with Jack, about caddying for his son as his son tried to make it as a pro golfer. Of course, this hour we've been talking about his mother's story, who died when she was just 19 years old, 16 days after Don and his twin brother were born. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.